Hey everyone, I know I don't usually start music on the rocks like this, but I just wanted to thank all of you guys for listening. This is a really fun thing for me to do, and as long as it keeps being fun, and as long as you guys keep listening, I will keep doing it. So here we are, another week, and I've got a great guest. She is and has been the top call French horn player on the Las Vegas Strip for many years now. She was one of my first horn teachers. And she's a super, super interesting person. And I know you guys will be interested in her too. So without further ado, here is Beth Lano.
How you doing, man?
Hey, what's going on?
Nothing. Everything good?
Yeah, it's great. Just got back from sledding with the kids and Tina.
Where'd you go?
At one of the schools. They've got like these big, huge hills and everybody goes there.
Oh, cool.
So, we can start anytime. So actually,
okay.
Kind of almost already started. So welcome to Music on the Rocks. This is your host, Chris Castellanos. And I have a really special guest with me today. This guest is really close to my heart. One of the first people that I took lessons from. Ever. I've got with me today, Beth Lano. Beth, how are you doing?
Hey, Chris, I'm fine. Thanks. Thanks for having me. I miss you. And we go back a few years, don't we?
A few. Yeah. More than I'd like to. I mean, it's crazy. Like how time is flying by, especially now that I'm in the house all the time. It feels like day after day feels the same.
How old were you when you started studying with me? What grade were you in?
I want to say I was in maybe eighth or ninth grade. I used to ride my bike to lessons and all that stuff. You know, you didn't live too far away from me. So
the first time I saw you, I was married to Joe at the time, and we were driving down Valley View, which is in Southeast Las Vegas, driving down Valley View. And I saw some kid walking down the street with carrying a horn case on his head. And I was like, hey, Joe, look at that. That kid's carrying a horn case. And a couple of months later, I got a call and you started studying with me. And it was a blast. But you were a great student. You were also a really interesting person, just even from that age. It was so much fun to teach you.
Oh, thanks. Well, I remember looking forward to our lessons so much because you always played for me in the lessons. So I was like really hearing that horn sound. I was like, man, that's what I want to sound like. So I used to look forward to going to lessons all the time. You'd play me recordings and we'd talk about all kinds of stuff, not even horn related.
Well, I taught you the way I was taught. You know, the teachers that I had that made the biggest difference to me, it wasn't just prepare three pieces, come into your lesson, play them, and then go home. It was never like that. And I think it's important when you're teaching to obviously to teach music and technique and things like that, but also to address life, because the musician is not just an instrument player, an instrument driver, an instrument jockey. A musician is a human being, and that's what forms them and makes them into great musicians.
Who did you learn that from? Who were you studying with?
My first major teacher when I was in high school was Fred Ennis at Ball State. And I believe you met Fred. Mm-hmm. And Fred was like that. Fred taught me a lot about how to play the horn, and boy, did I need the help. But he also, you know, he taught me a lot about how to be a flexible person, how to be completely adaptable as much as possible, how to take things in from many different directions and synthesize them. Take what you can learn from one person. Maybe it's not even on your own instrument, and file it away if it doesn't work for you right away. But always be receptive and like I said, flexible in everything that you do. So Fred was like that a whole lot.
Yeah, he was a really nice guy. I remember meeting him for the first time. I felt like I had known him for a long time. You know, he was just a really, really warm, nice person and very complimentary and really unassuming too. You wouldn't like just talking to him, I wouldn't have known he was like a really great horn player and a great teacher if I didn't know that already. You know what I mean? So. Yeah.
No, he's very humble, a very humble man, but a very wise one too.
Right.
And that was when I was in high school and before I ended up going to Ball State where he taught. But I would drive to Muncie, which was the next town over, and take lessons with him when I was in high school. I would cut school to go and hang out at Ball State and be around the other horn players. Because another thing that he taught me was surround yourself with people who play better than you do. Right. And always, as much as you can. So I took that to heart and I cut school to do it.
Did you find yourself taking to the horn pretty early on, or was it a kind of a difficult road for you, or did it come naturally?
Well, I came to the horn sort of circuitously. I started out as a violin player and I hated the fact that I played with a bad sound and out of tune. So I played violin for a couple of years. I switched to viola, thought that would be better. I quit playing any kind of music until that was like first and second grade. I played piano for a while. The teacher quit me because I would have her play the assignment and then I would play it back to her with the wrong fingers. and she refused to teach me. She fired me. Then I picked up trumpet in fifth grade and did that fifth and sixth, part of seventh, quit band because I didn't like the band director, took music appreciation where I picked up guitar, went back to band in eighth grade. In ninth grade, I was first chair trumpet in my junior high band, and the band director begged me to change to horn for just for one concert because they were playing American Overture for band and they only had three horns. American Overture for band is a big four horn feature. And I was like, man, I worked so hard to get to first chair and I really don't want to give it up. Oh, it'll be fine just for this one concert. Well, in a week, I went from fourth chair to first chair, fell in love with the horn and never looked back. And it didn't particularly come easy to me. I had to work really hard and I was behind because I'm a freshman in high school and some of these kids had played, since fifth or sixth grade.
Right.
And trying out for Allstate and things like that, where I thought I'd be a lock on the trumpet, not so much on the horn, because I wasn't as far along as everyone else was. But I did make it in. And then I left high school after my junior year and went to Ball State.
Okay. Yeah. I always wondered if it came really naturally to you because your ears are so good. I remember every gig that we would play together, there would be some point where you'd be fooling around and you'd play somebody else's part or you'd play a melody here and there. And you never seem to make mistakes when you're playing by ear. It's like you've just got really, really great ears. I don't hear that so much in even really great horn players, So is that something you worked on when you were young, playing by ear a lot?
Oh, yeah. First of all, I'd sneak down and play my sister's piano lessons when I was supposed to be taking a nap because I could hear them and I could go down and I could pick out the notes on the piano and play that stuff. So I had a good ear from the time I was a little kid. I could always match pitches. I could always play things back. I could always tell what key things were in. And I come from a family where nobody was a professional musician, but they all taught us how to really listen and what to listen for. My mom played trombone, and actually I have her trombone, which is kind of funny. It's an old Pan American trombone. It's out in my storage shed, but she had a good ear. And so did my dad. My dad was one of those people who could pick up an instrument, and play it, but he never really tried. So I think that just comes from, being around family who encourages it and being willing to listen closely.
Yeah. My family is really musical also. Both my parents, neither of them read music or anything, but my dad is a great percussion player and guitar player and singer.
Composer.
And my mom's a great singer too. And my sister, and she's a great percussionist. So it's like in my household, there was always music going on. And when we're in the car, nobody ever was singing the melody. Everybody's always singing a harmony. So we must have sounded like a Partridge Family thing going on or something.
Well, that's just it. I mean, that's kind of my family thing too. It's like, we'd we would sing and on car trips and stuff. And, you know, it wasn't enough to just add one harmony. I'm the youngest of four kids, and three out of the four of us, you know, had really good ears. And we would do four part harmony, you know, and we only got in trouble when my mom tried to sing. She had this incredible baritone voice. It was just like, not of this world. And that's not necessarily in a good way.
Oh, no. Well, I want to get to asking you a couple other questions, especially segueing off this. But first, this is Music on the Rocks, and I need to find out what it is that you're having to drink.
I'm having chai on the rocks, or as I like to call it, a Short Island iced tea.
That's awesome.
What are you drinking?
I'm having a gin and tonic was my go-to for the after Phantom drinks.
And oh, yeah.
So I figured that I would go with that. Isn't it crazy that Phantom started like 15 years ago and ended
9 years ago?
9 years ago. I'm thinking, what? Where did the time?
Well, it was like eight and a half. I mean, it was September of 2012,
yeah. So anyway, yeah, I'm having a gin and tonic. And this is actually kind of a cool thing. You know Lisa Maresch, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, her husband Raj got me this tonic that's from a local distillery in Utah. And it's like made out of like botanicals. It's like a cocktail syrup. So it's cool because you just like put a little cap full, like boop, into just a glass of gin. And you got yourself a gin and tonic, you know, kind of strong because there's no tonic water in there.
Oh, I was going to say, does it have like probiotics or, you know?
I don't know. Maybe. I'm going to pretend it does.
Well, cheers.
Cheers.
Yay.
All right. So how long were you at Ball State and what did you do after that?
I was at Ball State from the end of my junior year for like 3 years. And in between that, I won my first orchestra job with the Omaha Symphony after my sophomore year, actually. So it was after 2 years. And I was there for about a year because I was so young. And I thought, if you audition for a job and you win, you have to take it, right? And the job paid $90 a week. And even back then, that wasn't enough to live on. So I played most of the season. I ended up leaving and I went back to Ball State. And the following year, I got married and transferred to IU. It was kind of a last minute, Indiana University in Bloomington. Mm-hmm. It was kind of a last minute decision. So I sort of just showed up at IU in August of that year in time for the orchestra auditions because everybody had to have like ensemble placement and stuff. And I won. And it was like, because I was a last minute a student there, they didn't assign me to Mr. Farkas. They assigned me to Mr. Elworthy, who's the other horn professor. So I won first horn in the Philharmonic at IU, and Mr. Farkas was kind of like all in a huff because he said, well, you have to study with me. But his studio was full. So he said, well, you're signed up with Mr. Elworthy, so you'll study with him, but you'll also come study with me. So I got two lessons a week while I was at IU, which was just great because there were two completely different kinds of players. And you know this as a horn player, it's every horn player's dream to study with Philip Farkas.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, I was hoping I'd be able to, and I got to. So that was great. So I went to IU for a couple of years and didn't graduate. I ended up moving to Indianapolis, getting a divorce, moving to Indianapolis. And 8 months later, I got the job offer from Wayne Newton and moved out here.
Oh, man. So, well, now you're on the road with Wayne Newton. I mean, what was that like?
It was pretty freaky. I mean, I came out here with my best friend, the harpist, Kim Glennie, who's still my best friend. And we were two young girls from Indiana. She'd graduated from Indiana a few years before. And we worked together in studios and we were picked up out of a house band at a summer theater in Indianapolis, the last week of that summer theater season. And so we dropped everything and drove cross country for 3 days. And, you know, it was, I can remember driving over the hill coming from Boulder City and seeing the lights coming on and just being completely blown away. And the whole story of how we got here is another long story, which I won't bore you with. But getting out here, the first gig we played was we played one job at Bally's, but we had like 2 weeks at Caesar's Palace. So it was pretty intimidating. And Wayne's book was pretty intimidating too for young musicians, because he's got two books. One is a skeleton show. One is a thin book that's got mostly tunes that he does in every show. And then next to your chair is a big book of like 500 tunes, supposedly in alphabetical order. And as you know, many of those tunes start with horn solos. So you had to be quick on your feet. There often wasn't time when the piano player would start playing the first couple of bars of these tunes. You better have memorized those solos. And so that was an education, because if you messed up, you were messing up in front of an audience at Caesar's Palace. And at 22, 23 years old, that's pretty intimidating. Right. But we got to see a lot of the country, you know, got to see a lot of the world. And
he was really big at that time, too.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, this is like Mr. Las Vegas. Like, I mean, and I say what you want about Wayne Newton, but that guy could sing. Especially, have you ever seen those videos of him when he was really young? And he was like 15 and just like holding court on stage, just singing amazingly. And I mean, it's just really cool to watch.
Oh yeah. No. And he's another one. He was multi-talented. I mean, still is. I haven't seen he's doing, I think, kind of like a retrospective type show now. I don't know if it's even going on during the pandemic, but you know, playing a little violin, a little bluegrass violin, a little trumpet, you know, guitar. He was a consummate entertainer. And the crowds loved him. And we had people follow us from city to city. You know, you could see the same front three rows pretty much every night. People spent their life savings. They were, you know, they called themselves the Wayniacs, and they followed him. They followed him everywhere. But it was really fun. And there were a lot of really great musicians on those bands too.
Yeah. So how long did you play with Wayne?
Let's see, for 4 years, the first time, from like 82 to 86, and then picked it up again after the musician strike in 89, and from like 90 to 94, 93, 94.
Okay. Now, being in Las Vegas during the musician strike, that must have been something else. I mean, that was before my time of playing, you know, on the strip or anything like that. But I know that, I mean, a lot of my friends and great colleagues throughout the years went through that time. And I mean, what was that like?
It was awful. The issue during that strike was that five big hotels independently, I mean, that we weren't locked into the Bally's and Caesars conglomerate, or their Wynn and Venetian weren't here, but we had Tropicana, Flamingo, Hilton, two different Hiltons, Bally's, Caesars, I think maybe that's it. But anyway, each one of these hotels, kind of one at a time, starting with the Tropicana, went out on strike because they no longer wanted to guarantee a certain number, minimum number of musicians, 52 weeks of work a year. Mm-hmm. And I mean, for years and years in this town, there were guarantees. Each one of these hotels had like maybe 25 or 30 musicians, plus a leader, a conductor, band leader, contractor, who were guaranteed work every year. And in the mid to late 80s, these hotels decided they didn't want to do that anymore. And so they in June of 89, they locked out the band at the Folies Bergère, Tropicana. And I think that was 18 musicians and a leader. And then each of these other hotels followed suit, because some of the shows were production shows. Some of the shows were headliners. They were, we call them celebrity star policy rooms. Mm-hmm. And even the star policy rooms had guaranteed minimum numbers of musicians. And as you know, sometimes groups would come through that needed a full orchestra, but often groups would come in who did not need a full orchestra. and musicians got paid regardless, which was great for the musicians, but you can see where the hotels would not think that was so great. So they basically didn't want to guarantee the minimums, and they also wanted the ability to replace live musicians with taped stuff, synthesized stuff, and all of that. And I was working at Bally's in the Jubilee show at the time, and I would go out and walk the picket line at the Tropicana because we hadn't been locked up, we still had a job, and I would go walk the picket line, and then I lived not too far from the Trop at the time, and I would go back to my condo. And I'd sit down with my little word processing typewriter and I started writing the story of the strike. And I started writing press releases and I started making calls, because at 5 o'clock in the morning Vegas time, it was 8 o'clock in the morning New York time. Mm-hmm. And I started getting in touch with people and I started getting some coverage. We were getting all kinds of local coverage, and LA papers were picking things up, but I thought it's time that New York picks this up, you know. And I didn't know anything about public relations, but I was always a writer. So I started telling the story of the strike and started getting some press. And a few weeks later, I mean, we didn't have Google at that time, you know, we didn't have the internet. So I would go out and buy copies of newspapers and magazines, and I started finding where we'd been covered. And I put together a press kit, went into the office of the president of the Musicians Union here, put the press kit down on his desk, and he says, "What's this?" And I said, "It's press coverage. I want to be your director of public relations." And he hired me. So I spent the entire strike as director of public relations, and not making much money, being on call 24 hours a day, but doing interviews and trying to raise awareness and, putting together rallies and making up T-shirts, some of which I can't even repeat the slogans for, but we had a blast doing that. And we ended up losing the strike, and the musicians ended up, you know, there were like 46 musicians, I think, in total, who were guaranteed. And then all of the rest of the membership was in support of those musicians. And we ended up getting severance pay, severance packages. But it was a really hard time for us, because the lawyers for the hotels were suggesting things like, well, one of their offers was, we'll retrain musicians as sous chefs.
Okay.
And it was stuff like that. They obviously didn't understand what it means to be a musician and what it means to put in all of that time and so much of yourself into learning a musician. It's not just punching a time card. You know, this is who we are.
Yeah, it seems like they just don't understand that it's not a couple of years or 4 years of training for a sous chef or something. I mean, it's a whole different world, music.
Yeah, so. Yeah, it completely is. But I mean, you know, we ended up losing, but we ended up garnering something like $3 million worth of free publicity, which was a lot back then, and you know. And here we are today. You know, the music scene in Las Vegas is way different than it used to be.
Yeah.
And we, you know, it's a lot different. There's still work here, as you know, but it's not like it used to be.
Right. So you wear a lot of hats, and I've always admired the way that you kind of go into things that are completely different, you know, musician and public relations, and then like voiceover stuff, and then radio personality and all this. And but you seem to always have so much confidence in whatever it is that you're doing, even if maybe it's not something that you feel was a strong suit right away, but you go in head first, you know, and it's like you go in with this confidence that makes other people go, wow, she knows what she's doing, even if maybe you don't know what you're doing. Where did you get that from? Like, how do you even train yourself to feel like you can do that kind of thing?
I have no idea. I mean, I think it... Thank you for that. I've just never felt that it's a good idea to just do one thing, because I have so many interests in so many different things, you know, and I figure I've always been a writer. So writing helps me in so many other areas. It helped me in public relations and marketing and advertising. And it actually helps me in my voice acting stuff too. And it certainly helped me in my radio. But it's one of those things where if you don't know how to do something, don't say you know how to do it. Learn everything you can. So you admit when you don't know how to do something and then spend all your time figuring out how to do it right.
Right.
So I don't know it's necessarily confidence. I mean, there have been times in every single one of these careers where I've been completely low and full of self-doubt, you know, but I think that's normal for everything, music too.
I can't think of one single time I've seen you do something or heard you do something where it didn't seem like you were completely at home. Like, just, you have this thing about you that just works, you know? So how did you even get into the radio? I remember listening to you on the radio station and stuff as a DJ. How do you get into that world?
Part of the PR and marketing thing from the musician strike, I started doing voice work. And so one of the places where I worked, one of the studios where I worked, and, you know, just as I was a freelance voice talent. So everything that I did was just work that I hustled. And so this one studio, I worked regularly with this guy who turned out to be the production director at a news radio station. And he said, "Hey, there's an opening. They're going to add a female anchor to their afternoon drive newscasts. And it's like a four to eight shift. And you should go audition for it." I said, "Okay." I was like a news junkie, so it seemed like a natural fit. And again, so that's where playing music helps you and having a good ear, because I could listen to the news and I knew what the cadence of the delivery was. Mm-hmm. And I could write. So I had that going for me too, to audition, because you don't just go in and read the news. You also have to write it. So I went in and auditioned for it and got the job as an afternoon drive anchor on a news station here for about a year. And I got word that they were going to downsize because they were going to sell that news radio station. So I started looking for another job and got one before they let me go. And it was doing morning drive news on a radio morning show. Mm-hmm. And so I took that job and within 6 months had a really nice contract and wasn't just the newsreader anymore. I was like morning drive co-host. And so I kept doing that for about a little more than 10 years mm-hmm. on three different stations within the same company. But that was totally fun.
Yeah.
A lot of work, but totally fun.
I didn't know like your progression to getting into that. I just knew all of a sudden you're on the radio. I'm like, how the she plays horn? Like, now she's on the news. And so what you're saying is that you've just never kind of shut any doors. You've, whatever it is that you want to get into, that you're doing your homework on that, and that you're the best possible package that you can present when you want to present it to somebody to maybe get a job doing that.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I came of age during a time when musicians, not as much in Las Vegas, but if you lived in New York or LA or Chicago and you had a day gig, I mean, people kept day gigs secret because you were kind of looked down on if you weren't making all of your living from playing your instrument. Mm-hmm. And I always thought that was just completely jive. You know, you should take pride in what everything you do. And if you do it well, why should you hide it? So I thought from when I first moved here, the first couple of years, all I did was music. And frankly, I was bored. And I kept writing during this whole time, but I was really looking for an outlet by the time I got that job doing PR for the Musicians Union. Mm-hmm. And I kept being flexible. And boy, I'll tell you something, during a pandemic, I'm really glad I have these other talents and these other career paths, because when you have these different things that you can do, you can be flexible. I miss my music jobs. I miss playing and making music with people terribly, but I'm able to support myself by pouring the steam on with my teaching studio and going out and hustling some more voice work, some of which I can do from my bedroom closet, you know, and occasionally go into a studio, but try to, you know, try to stay away from people as much as possible. I can do some freelance PR and some consulting. And then I also have the job as PR and marketing director for UNLV School of Music. So I've got those things going for me, and it's thank goodness I do. Thank goodness I've got that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that a lot of musicians kind of struggle with that, being looked down upon if you don't make all of your money playing. You know, it's like, oh, what, you're not good enough to make a living just only playing or something. And even teaching gets looked down upon, you know, mm-hmm. by people, which I completely don't understand. I mean, did you see that new movie? What's the new, is it a Pixar movie or?
Soul.
Soul, yeah. And I had a lot of friends who, you know, they love the movie, but they had took issue with the fact that, you know, he went to the gig and the first thing that the sax player says is, oh, we're down to junior high band directors now or whatever it is. And, you know, and I get it. I understand why people would be offended by something like that, because to tell you the truth, some of the best musicians that I played with when I was on the strip were junior high band directors also, you know?
Yeah.
And they're the people who are bringing up the next generation of musicians. And I mean, my very first band director was a great musician, you know? I mean, Ed Jackson.
Who was it?
Well, Ed Jackson.
Oh, Ed. Yeah.
And then right after that was Craig Yancey. And he was on the strip playing sax. I mean, this guy was an amazing player. And then, you know, we played with Tom Snelson, who was an amazing trumpet player and was a band director, and Doug Beasley, an amazing horn player and band director. It's like Reed. It's like you can go on and on, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm going on a little rant about teaching and playing, but also the same thing applies to people who have careers outside of music. I mean, just because they are doing other things doesn't mean they're not a great musician also, you know?
No, we have so many friends who are fantastic musicians. Mm-hmm. And successful musicians who work in insurance and in, you know, and some of our very best friends. And I mean, there are so many different ways to make a life. It's not just making a living, it's making a life. And trying to fit musicians into a certain category, you have to do it this way, is where I draw the line. It's like, no, you don't have to do that.
Right. Oh, that's really refreshing to hear. And I'm sure that a lot of people who are listening are really happy to hear that. You also don't want to burn out on music or anything. You need other outlets. To me, I have to do other stuff too. I don't make a living doing too much other stuff, but I've got great hobbies, you know, and especially now that I have kids.
What are your hobbies?
Well, right now, you could say video editing. I love doing that stuff, and I'm learning a lot about it. I've been interested in it for a long time, but now I've kind of got the tools. And so I just mess around with doing a little YouTube page for my son.
And it's so cool.
And I'm learning how to do the editing and stuff. I'm getting better from like episode to episode. It's getting a little bit more entertaining. And I'm doing it as much for me as that I'm doing for him, you know, because it's fun to play with him. And also just to see him watch himself afterwards, he like loves it. And then I just think, you know, this is going to be great when I'm, you know, 70 and I can like look back on these things when he was a little kid and I'm playing with him and we're doing little fun little YouTube episodes and stuff. But that and RC cars, I'm getting back into that, you know, which is a great
full circle.
Yeah. And that's a great one to do with my son because, I mean, we do the hobby grade cars. So it's like every part is replaceable. And it's like when you break something, I teach him how to take it off, take it apart, install the new one, and including the electronics and the motor and the servos and all that. So it's kind of a good thing for him to learn also just about mechanics and everything too, even if it's on a small scale. So those are the kind of things that I'm doing right now.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's fun. So what do you do hobby-wise?
I hike. I love to hike. I haven't been hiking as much as I used to because I like to go up to Mount Charleston and Red Rock, and it's a little bit too crowded, and people aren't real careful about wearing masks and stuff like that. So kind of trying to go off the beaten path. So I do working out. I love to work out. I love to hike, take care of myself. Reading when it's warm, I swim, work in my yard. Gardening has become a big thing. I love taking care of my yard.
Yeah, I really enjoy getting out in the yard too. So playing wise, what have you been doing lately just to kind of keep up your chops? And I mean, have you been able to play any gigs or anything lately?
Let's see. Not really. I mean, I've done videos for people, things like that. But as far as gigs, no, I haven't done any remote recording for any sessions or anything like that. But playing wise, this has actually been a kind of a cool time for me because I had an injury a couple of years ago that I never really, I could never really take any time off, any meaningful time off. So the first few months of the shutdown, I just thought, well, I'm going to play a little bit, but I'm really going to take care of my face and I'm going to come back really, really mindfully. So I've sort of been building my embouchure back up, and in doing that, just going back to basics and doing fundamentals, enjoying practicing and realizing that it's only because of this terrible time and we're forced to be inside that I actually have the time to sit down and spend dedicated time each day really thinking about the fundamentals of my embouchure. So as I built my embouchure up from that, I started going and doing things like the entire Belloli Etude book. Just start at the front and go to the back, then go to the next book and just keep playing that stuff. Mm-hmm. And I play in all of my students' lessons and working on stuff that my students are working on so I can keep up with them. Right. So it's been a great opportunity, picking out concertos that, it's like I worked up Strauss 2 in the last few months because I never really sat down and spent the time to work it up because mm-hmm. I was always out working, four gigs. Now I'm still working a lot from home, but I don't have the commute. So I have extra time that I can sit down and dedicate to practicing. So, and I just started working, our good friend, Aaron Robinson for Christmas gave me the real book in F. Oh. And I have like four copies of the real book in my house, but none of them are in F. And I've always wanted to start, learning bebop heads, but learn them correctly, not just play them by ear and kind of think, I think that's close enough. So, since Christmas, I've been working on Donna Lee, and I started it out really slowly, mm-hmm. gradually picked it up until I got it up to about quarter note equals 180, which isn't nearly fast enough, but that's the fastest I can play it clean. But it's things like that. It's like give yourself a goal and work towards it and everything. And in the process, I'm healed from that injury, and I feel like my chops are stronger than they've been in a long time.
That's really, really great. Yeah, I mean, when you're a freelance musician, if something goes awry, you don't really have the luxury of taking time off and doing it the right way. You just kind of have to power on. So now, are you still playing your hill?
Yes, I'm playing a hill single B flat with an FA extension. And I also am playing a Yamaha 667V with a Berg pipe.
Oh, those are good ones.
Yeah. I may be selling that one because I really don't play it all that much. But it's a great horn. It's the one that Sandra had.
That is a great
one. But it really is. But I play the single B flat all the time, and I have for 30 years.
It's funny. Please tell that story. Okay. So I tell this story to a lot of people when they're talking about how important it is to play the same horn as everybody else in a section. And you can only get this sound off of this horn and stuff. You got to tell our listeners this story about the Boston Symphony audition.
Oh, it was the audition before Boston. So it was Baltimore.
Oh, it was Baltimore. Okay. Yeah.
It was Baltimore. Yeah. One year I did auditions for assistant in Baltimore and principal in Boston. So the Boston audition was first, and then the Baltimore was after that. And so, I played the audition and I thought I did pretty well, but I didn't think I did well enough to get the job. But Carl Hill, who built my horn, told me, he says, call up, and the name escapes me right now. He says, here's this guy's number, call the principal horn player, call him up. like the day after the audition and ask him for notes. He says, there's nothing wrong with that. And so I mustered up the courage and I called them and I said, hey, this is Beth Lano. And I auditioned yesterday and my number was 57. And could you please, would you mind giving me some notes on my audition? And he says, oh, sure. No problem. I told him, Carl, he'll give me your number, you know, because I didn't want him to think that I was just some crazy stalker.
Right.
So he says, yeah, hang on. So he goes and gets his notes and he says, good player, West Coast studio player, 8D. And I started laughing and he says, what's so funny? And I said, I'm almost on the West Coast, Las Vegas. So that's pretty good. I said, but I don't play an 8D. He says, what do you play? And I said, I play a Carl Hill single B flat. He goes, oh my God. he says, you get a big dark sound on that horn. And then a few years ago, well, I'd say, gosh, like 10 or 12 years ago now, playing Andrea Bocelli at the Hollywood Bowl. The first time I went to the Hollywood Bowl, and it was the first time I got to play with Jim Thatcher. So there are four horns in that section. And so I go in there and I sit down and we were sitting European style. So I was playing third. I'm sitting behind Jim. And at the first break on the rehearsal, he goes, what are you playing back there? And I said, it's a Carl Hill single B flat. He goes, wow. He says, it's a really dark, big, full sound. He says, I would never think that was a single B flat. And you fit in great. And he was playing his old con at the time. So it's more the player than the horn.
Right. Yeah. I've always adored your horn sound. And, you know, I've had teachers who have had completely different sounds too. I mean, it's like yours, you've got like this really warm, like dark chocolate sound, you know, but it's really broad, a big core to the sound. And then there's Bill and he's got like this crystal clear soloistic thing going on.
Love his sound.
Yeah. Oh, I love his sound too. So it's really cool how unique a sound is to people because Bill sounded like that when he was playing his 8D. I think when I started playing with my quintet, Boston Brass, I was playing an 8D. And then I switched to this Yamaha that I'm playing right now, 871. And it's a totally different horn. And I still feel like I sound like myself, but the guys, they're like, dude, I can hear you so much better now. You know, and I'm not doing anything different. It's actually, I'm playing easier. You know, I'm not playing as hard. So yeah, it's interesting.
Well, I have to, that Yamaha that you're playing now, prints better, you know, it records, it picks up better. It's, and you still sound like you. I mean, I've known you for how many years and you still sound like you, but you sound like you, if I can use a bad analogy, like I'm listening to you through glasses with the right prescription. In other words, I could always make you out, but now I'm really hyper-focused on you. I mean, I think you really sound amazing. You always sound amazing, but you sound even better on this horn.
Oh, thanks. Well, I enjoy it. I enjoy it a lot, you know. And like I said, I don't have to work as hard with this horn, especially in the quintet setting where the second half of the show, everybody's playing really loud and they're all bell front, except for the tuba. It's just like, I kind of have to have something that has some zing to it, you know.
Who edited the video, the latest one that I saw, the Harry Janos?
Actually, Jose did the video editing on that one.
That was beautiful. The playing was magnificent, but the editing too was really fun.
Yeah, it was a fun one. And the arrangement our tuba player, William, did. And
it's brilliant.
Yeah, you know, I miss the guys, so I miss like being on the road and seeing everybody. It's, you're used to something for almost two decades. And then all of a sudden it's just like, okay, you're grounded. You know, like,
well, they're your brothers, you know, and I've been lucky enough to go out on a couple of those gigs with you guys and the camaraderie is just absolutely wonderful. And I can see where it's like, you know, you're separated from your family. You really are.
Yeah. Yeah, it's rough, but I know it's rough for so many musicians out there right now and people who are used to making a certain living, doing one thing and they don't have all the tools in the toolkit that you do, you know? I mean, I think that's a big eye opener. I mean, we all know that it's not the most stable thing to go into and it's not the easiest thing to go into, but I never thought that it could just get like snagged and just like, yeah, good luck.
Well, it's frightening and I'm, you know, it scares me for the future of the arts in general. I mean, it's musicians and it's actors and it's singers and I mean,
stage crew.
My gosh. I think we're going to emerge from this, but you know, things are going to be different for a lot of these organizations, for these arts organizations. And it's, you know, a lot of them are going to have to rebuild depending on what happens. So we're going to all have to wait and see and be ready to jump in and help where we can, you know, if we can.
As a PR and marketing expert, what would be some advice that you could give to somebody who's trying to stay a little bit relevant?
Well, off the top of my head, I think the biggest thing is to keep creating content. Keep creating content and getting it out there, because it's really important for people not to have the idea that you're just waiting out the pandemic. And then when it's done, you expect to, you know, just go back to normal, because the new normal is not going to be the same. Nobody knows what it's going to be like. We just know that it'll be different. Mm-hmm. So I would say continue to reach out, be flexible, produce content that's representative and quality. And, you know, just keep your name out there. If you're not normally somebody who does videos and, you know, like, you know, getting on a cappella and doing duet videos, try it, you know, put a little bit of time and effort into it and produce some stuff. Doesn't have to be perfect, but it does have to be good,
right?
But it doesn't have to be perfect, but put yourself out there. Look like you're, you know, let people know that you're not just waiting for this to be over. You're actually making good use of your time and you're thinking about, you know, connecting with other people.
Right. Do you have any thoughts on what is too much and what's not enough, or like the Goldilocks kind of formula of it's always a fine line to walk between not being seen at all or just like being oversaturated so much that people are just like, all right, I'm going to mute this person now.
Well, I think you should figure out what your focus is. You know, if you're a symphonic musician, it's perfectly fine to share things that orchestras are doing. If not your own orchestra, other orchestras. Mm-hmm. I stay away from politics. I use Facebook, for example. Facebook for me it's gigs and hikes and animals and sharing memories of past performances these days. And I'm probably on Facebook less than any of them. Instagram is a little bit different. I mean, your audience for each of these channels is going to be slightly different. Facebook is basically for your friends and family, but it doesn't skew younger. Instagram has a lot of middle-aged and older users too, but it does definitely skew younger than Facebook does. But the same things apply kind of for Instagram. Don't go nuts with memes. If you want to be taken seriously as a musician, just watch the memes and everything. Don't get political. You know, it's okay to be spiritual, but don't be pushing things on people. It's like religion, sex, and politics are kind of taboo when you're trying to maintain a brand. And don't try to be too cute. You want to be political? Go to Twitter.
Yeah. Well, Twitter, I think I've erased Twitter, or it's at least very inactive. I don't know. I can't handle it. It's like so, it's too negative for me. And it's too sarcastic and sardonic. And just like everything is just has to be like this quip or this bringing somebody down or a couch comedian or something, you know.
It'll change though. I mean, as Twitter kind of evolved, Twitter went from people trying to be armchair comedians and, you know, and deep thinkers and all of that to places where people go to follow news more than anything else. Then it evolves around election times, whether it's presidential or midterm, it evolves into more of a political channel. And I think within the next year, it'll probably go back to the appropriate amount of snark and entertainment news and armchair comedians with politics never leaving, but it's a whole different animal. My advice for musicians is, you know, go be on Twitter if you want to, but don't use that for, it's not a good place for promotion for musicians.
Right. What do you think about TikTok?
TikTok is great fun, and TikTok is a great tool. You can do all kinds of fun things, but again, it's like TikTok is like a spice you don't want to use too much, because it's really easy to go overboard with the TikToks, and TikToks sometimes become like, you know, becomes meme like.
Right.
It can be really, really useful, but it can also be really, really annoying.
Yeah, my daughter is the one who showed me TikTok, because she's 15. I mean, kids her age, that's basically, they're doing that and they're doing Instagram, you know, too big. And there's some others that are even too new and hip for me.
You know, me too.
But yeah, she showed me TikTok and she's like, you should put a video on here. And I was like, all right, so what should I do? And she's showing me and she's like, okay, do this video, but like, you have to like put this like funny thing on here and
filter.
Yeah. And you have to put this caption on for the video. I was like, all right. So I did that. And like within, I don't know, within like 10 days, I had like 17,000 followers on TikTok. Like, what the heck? How do you, and they're all young people and not, yeah. And they're, I mean, I had a lot of people like, so I've posted, I don't know, maybe like 20 videos on there now. And it's all kind of just recycled stuff from videos I had before, but with funny captions that my daughter comes up with or that I come up with. But I have a lot of like college students and people, oh yeah, you came to my school, you played blah, blah, blah. So it's like, it is a way to get younger people to at least look at music. And it's kind of like a gateway to maybe checking you out on, well, oh, maybe this person's got like an album. Maybe I'll check it out on iTunes, or maybe they're on YouTube and there's some more content there, you know, because it used to be when you were younger, when I was younger, you know, I would go to Tower Records and I would just like flip through like the brass section or the French horn section. I'd see what new CDs were out and stuff. And now, I mean, people put out new albums all the time and you never hear about it. And you don't know what is new, and you're not waiting on bated breath for the next album of your favorite player to come out and stuff. It's just stuff just kind of materializes, and maybe you stumble upon it, maybe you don't. And it's like, so how are these younger, like these kids who are at an impressionable age, how are they supposed to stumble across something?
Yeah.
You know,
Instagram is great for that too. I mean, you can do like a direct, you can reach people directly on Instagram. Instagram has more followers than TikTok, but TikTok's growing by the minute, you know.
Well, and TikTok as a creator, you can at least make a little bit of money too. It's way easy.
So, I haven't tried that yet.
Well, I mean, it's just, you just sign up for like the thing. And if you've got over a certain amount of followers and you're over the age of 18, it starts per however many views that you get so many cents. So it's like, you know, every once in a while you just check and it's like, oh, wait a minute, I have money in a TikTok account that I can just transfer to the bank. The heck?
That's great.
That's really
Are you still monetizing YouTube?
I never was.
I have a friend who had a 16-year-old son, was 16, like 10 or 12 years ago. And he was doing YouTube makeup tutorials, and he made so much money. He was able to buy a brand new Jeep.
Wow.
Before he could drive. He wasn't 16 yet. I think this all happened when he was 14 and 15.
That's amazing. I remember that actually.
Yeah.
It's hard for musicians to monetize on YouTube unless you're creating your own content that has nothing to do with anybody else's music. Like, okay, I put up many years ago, like maybe 10 years ago, I put up a video of myself doing a like 8-horn or 10-horn arrangement of Parade of the Ewoks.
Oh, and, yeah.
Yeah, and I put that up and it got a good fair amount of views, but then it got silenced. They turned the sound off of it and they said that it was, you know,
violation of copyright law.
Yeah, and so I had to write to them and I was like, look, I'm not making any money off of this, and I played everything on here. You know, it's not like I'm selling anything, and it's not like it's not me playing. And so they put the sound back on. But now when you go into the monetization, it says that it's going to John Williams people. And it's like, so all the horn karaoke stuff that I do with like Queen, and that's got a good amount of views and all that stuff, that all goes to those people who own the music, you know? So I don't even try to monetize on YouTube. That's for me to just put stuff up for fun.
Chris, makeup tutorials. I'm telling you, you've got to do you.
My wife and my daughter, that's what they should be doing. Talk about somebody who is into diversifying income streams. I mean, Tina is my wife. She's a fabulous flute player. She plays principal with the Las Vegas Philharmonic, and she plays with the Utah Symphony all the time. And she's just an amazing player. Somebody who makes a full-time living playing her instrument, but she also has other businesses. You know, she's got a side makeup business because she enjoys makeup and beauty products. And then she's also got a side health business because she enjoys being healthy. And it's something that she was taking before she even tried to be part of selling anything, you know? So yeah. What I'm getting at is she should be the one to be on YouTube doing this, but she's too shy to do anything like that.
Oh, she should totally do it. And Lily can help her with that.
Yeah.
She should.
How are your cats?
They're good. They're yelling at me that it's almost time for, it's like almost time for dinner.
Yeah.
But they're good. And you got a cat too, huh?
Yeah. I finally broke down. The only annoying part is that I've got like little cat hairs everywhere, 'cause I like to wear black. And so like everything has little cat hair on it now.
in the grand scheme of things, it could be way worse. And they're great little personalities. They're so cool.
Yeah.
So, well, hey, we were supposed to be doing Kelly Clarkson together, right?
Yeah. We should have been doing that. Like,
we had like five different dates, but if they do that tour the way it was planned, it's supposed to be like over a year and a half, 2 years. So we'll have some work over that period with Kelly Clarkson.
I know Tina really likes her. Yeah, she sounds great. So yeah, I was disappointed that wasn't going to happen.
Me too. I was so looking forward to getting a chance to, anytime I get a chance to work with you, it's fun, but she's awesome. Did Tina do that Kelly Clarkson Christmas special we did?
She probably was. Yeah, I'm not sure if she was on it, but she was supposed to be on this thing also. Because we were excited because we were going to see all of our friends. And it worked out perfectly with the Boston Brass Tours too. It was like just like kind of snuggled in to like the openings. And then everything got erased. So whatever.
Yeah.
At least now I can race my RC cars around with my son and crash things and break them and be a boy, you know. So
yeah. And teach your son how to fix them.
Exactly. Well, this has been so much fun.
Oh,
just to see you.
It's been great.
You look great, by the way.
Thanks. So do you.
I can tell that you're like way into being healthy and everything.
Thank you. That's the other thing this pandemic has done. It's made me really think, you know, can't just give lip service to I'm going to take care of myself. Now we really have to take care of ourselves. Health is really important.
For sure. That's why I'm drinking a gin and tonic.
I had enough alcohol in my life. I'm fine with tea and water now.
I like the tea and water because it still looks like you're having like a whiskey rocks or something like that, you know? Well, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me. This was a blast. Hopefully we'll be able to see each other sooner rather than later.
For sure.
Thanks so much, Chris.
All right, Beth. I'll catch you later. All right. Thank you.
Okay. Give my love to Tina and the kids.
I will, for sure.
All right. See ya.